Welcome, everybody, to This Week in Mormons with your hosts, Matt and Melissa. How are you, Melissa?
I'm really good today. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing great.
I'm really excited. We're doing an interview today, listeners, and I'm super excited. Matt asked me if there was one person I wanted to interview, who it would be, and I picked Patrick Mason, and that's what we've got.
So, yeah, Patrick, you're joining us today. How do you like to introduce yourself, Patrick?
However you want to.
I mean, Patrick, they're great.
Well, there's that Saint Patrick. I prefer. No, I'm married, have four kids. We live here in Logan, Utah. I teach at Utah State University. So I'm a professor here. I teach courses in Mormon history and lots of other fun things, and written some stuff. And I just like talking with fun and smart people.
Oh, awesome. Good. Well, I wish us luck today on the fun and smart part. You have a really formal title, like the Leonard J. Arrington Chair of, I don't know, is that the whole title?
You're doing great. Okay. It's the Leonard J. Arrington Chair of Mormon History and Culture.
Okay.
It's a bit of a mouthful.
So that is a mouthful, but it makes you seem important.
So have you ever met Leonard Arrington?
I never met Leonard Arrington. So he passed away just as I was kind of coming into the field of Mormon history. And so he was for people who don't know, he was a giant in the field of Mormon history. In a lot of ways, we think of him as like the godfather or grandfather of academic Mormon history. He was the church historian for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for several years. But he was a professor here at Utah State University before that. So that's why the chair in Mormon history is named after him. So I've met his family members and developed a great relationship with them. They've been really wonderful and welcoming to me, but I never got to meet Leonard.
So did Michael Quinn pass away recently? People have been talking about it. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So for our listeners who don't know, like, Michael Quinn also seemed to have a really big impact on Mormon history. Like, how would you describe what he did for Mormon history?
Huge. I mean, he worked with Leonard Arrington in the church history department. So when Arrington went down, this was in the early 1970s, and to kind of professionalize the church history department and really kind of bring it up to more scholarly standards. And he brought together a bunch of young historians, just really talented historians. And Michael Quinn was one of these. He went on, got his PhD at Yale, was incredibly productive, wrote a bunch of books that are really important and articles that are really important. And he was oftentimes drawn to topics that were, especially at the time, more controversial. Mm-hmm. So he talked about kind of folk magic and early Mormonism. He talked about conflicts within the LDS church leadership. He talked about post-manifesto polygamy. So he wrote and published articles on that, you know, kind of got him into some hot water. Now he's largely been vindicated on a lot of those things. I mean, we go back and obviously we know a little bit more than he did a few decades ago, or the scholarship has continued to progress, but still his scholarship was foundational. He's a bit of a tragic figure. He was excommunicated from the church. So there's a kind of sad part of that story, but his scholarship, still is really important for anybody who gets into the field of Mormon studies.
So how many universities, or maybe a percentage, have Mormon studies as a topic to study? And then who takes your classes, history students, or would you major in Mormon studies?
Yeah, great question. So very few universities have formal kind of professorships dedicated to Mormon studies. So Utah State, Claremont Graduate University in Southern California, the University of Virginia, and the University of Utah. Those are the ones with professorships in Mormon studies. Lots of other universities offer courses in Mormon history. Sometimes, you know, some of them might surprise people just because it's kind of an inherently interesting subject. So I know lots of colleagues in the field who teach courses. But here at Utah State, in terms of my students, so I teach a big course every spring on Mormon history. It's got 100 students in it. It's in a big auditorium. Wow. And it's full every semester with a wait list. I have a colleague who teaches it every fall. It fills for her. So it's a really popular class here. But here it fulfills a Gen Ed designation. So actually, most of the students in the class, they're not history majors. They're not religious studies majors. They're from all over the university. I've got, you know, engineers and aviation people business people and economics and nursing and everything else. And I actually love that.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, I never ask anybody what their religious affiliation is, but sometimes you can tell based on how they approach the subject. So I'd say, and you know, this is unique about USU. It's a state university, but it's in Utah. So I'd say maybe 2/3 of the students in there are probably active LDS. A lot of them return missionaries and so forth. Probably about 1/4 of them are kind of post LDS. Raised Mormon and now are either in the process of leaving or have left and are still wrestling with some questions. And then there's maybe 10% or so from out of state or who grew up here who aren't LDS at all. And they're just like trying to get their bearings and trying to learn about this thing. So
what are the big questions that young adults are wondering about right now?
Oh, geez, where do we start?
I'd
say the biggest one, especially in recent years, has been around LGBTQ inclusion within the church. That has emerged over the past 5 years, I'd say, as the biggest issue, especially for younger people. Church history issues are still prominent for a lot of people, whether it be polygamy, whether it be race in the priesthood. Oftentimes, it's around some of these kinds of social and cultural questions, but still other issues too, like Book of Abraham and Book of Mormon translation and some things like that. And then there's just persistent concerns about women's roles in the church and gender inclusion and equality within the church. I'd say those are kind of the big ones.
So as a professor of history or in any role you want to choose, how does your knowledge of history kind of inform your interpretation of doctrine? And do you find that people are asking you to use history to explain doctrine? And like, is that appropriate? Like, how do you deal with that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's a great question.
And yeah, good question, Matt.
You ought to have a podcast. But I think it's terrific. And for me, of course, history is central. It's really important. I've dedicated my life to it. And partly I do that just because I'm interested in it. There's lots of things to be interested in. Not everybody has to be a historian. But I do think that there's something unique about Christianity and particularly the Restoration in terms of our relationship to history. Because as Christians, we believe one of our foundational claims is that God entered history. It's the incarnation, right? That Jesus entered the flesh. He came into the world in a time and place and culture. And so God entered the world in a very real way. And in the Restoration, we double down on that, right? That Jesus, you know, has re-entered the world. And we can point to times and places and things where that happened. And I think our faith is a historical faith, and history does matter. We make claims about history. We make claims about the way that God acts in history. So I think history is a really useful and even essential tool to think about the work of God in the world. It's not the only tool, though. You don't have to have a PhD in history. You don't even have to be a deep student of history in order to, you know, have a testimony of the gospel and so forth. But I do think that for me, thinking about history and studying it does shape my theology. I think I would say in a couple of different major ways. One is that it gives me a fair bit of patience. You know, historians, we take the long view and I know that things have changed in the past. And so if things aren't exactly perfect right now, the one thing I'm pretty confident in is change. And so I know things now, I don't know always the way things are going to change. It doesn't make me a prophet. But I'm comfortable with change. I'm comfortable with change in the past. I'm comfortable with change in the present. I'm comfortable with change in the future. That's just partly what it means to be a historian. And then second of all, I'm just really comfortable with the human element in religion. So as I study history, as I study scripture, I just see humans all over the place. I see it as co-participation with God, humans and God kind of walking hand in hand. And so I'm not surprised either when I see humans either doing admirable things or humans kind of mucking it up. That's just kind of what I expect. And so I'm not troubled by it.
Yeah. I wonder, as you walk through these issues with students, like, are they searching just for understanding, or are they, is this generation more of one that is pushing for and looking for change?
I think it's both. It probably depends on the person, right? Uh-huh. Some are, and I've, you know, it's, I teach the class and there's 100 of them sitting there. Well, they're not all there every day, but 100 of them enrolled. But then a lot of them find their way into my office for just one-on-one conversations. And and it's a little bit of both. So, sometimes they're just really interested in the history. They're interested in knowing what exactly happened. I think there's a sense among many of them that they haven't gotten the full story growing up, you know, either in seminary or whatever. And some are resentful about that. Others just recognize, oh, it was seminary, right? I wasn't going to get like the college level treatment of the history. And so, but a lot of them, yeah, it's like, oh, wow, I've spent a lot of years in the church and I've gone on a mission and so forth. This is all new to me, whatever that might be. And so part of it is just on a kind of factual and understanding and historical level, but others really are wrestling with what does this mean for the issues that I care about now, right? So as I mentioned, lots of them care about greater women's equality within the church and LGBTQ inclusion. So what if some of these lessons and precedents in the past, how do they apply to these things that I care about today? And so we'll talk a lot about that, about sometimes the way that history is useful in thinking about those ways, and maybe some ways that actually it's not quite as similar as they might think on the surface.
So I'm going to try and merge two ideas together. There's the one idea is history as a historian would approach it, and history as a tool to evangelize. And then the other subject is the church's recent purchase of so many of the Kirtland Temple and various things that the Joseph Smith family had. How do you feel about this, kind of the church owning history and evangelizing with history?
Yeah. Great question. I'd say, first of all, I mean, nobody owns history. People can own property, but nobody owns history. History is the ultimate public good. We make claims on history. People can frame history. People can tell these different stories, but none of these stories are owned by anybody. Joseph Smith isn't owned by Latter-day Saints. The Kirtland Temple, again, the property can be owned by somebody, but the stories around it, the history isn't. So I think that's important to recognize. But I do think, you know, again, because history matters so much to Latter-day Saints, that's why the church, you know, has been so, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has been willing to spend so much money on securing and then improving and preserving these historic sites, right? Because like the Kirtland Temple, it's not, yes, it's a historic landmark, but for Latter-day Saints, like Jesus literally appeared here,
right? Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something like, you know, getting a piece of property in the Holy Land, right? Where Jesus was, and you can't really put a price on that. And so that does really matter in terms of our identity, our theology, who we are as a people. So I think it's very appropriate for the church to do that. I will say that with this purchase this week, you know, I have a lot of friends in Community of Christ, and there's a lot of mixed feelings about sure. this. They recognize that this is a way for them to secure their future because it's a church like lots of other churches that's been struggling financially recently. And so this is a huge windfall, a huge infusion of cash that's going to allow them to operate and even expand their ministries. And so that's a great thing for them, but it's at the price of losing, you know, losing these pieces of their past and their heritage that they care a lot about. And so there is some sadness there. And my sadness as a historian, while the LDS Church is phenomenally good at historical preservation, I mean, really like A++++ in terms of the way that we invest in and do the just top-notch historical preservation, Also, those tours are going to be given by volunteer missionaries, right? And and we all, anybody who's been to a church historic site knows that, you know, you get what you pay for. They're free tours, you know, by missionaries who may or may not care much about history. And I always liked the fact that when people went to Kirtland or went to Nauvoo, they were confronted with the reality that there are multiple restoration stories.
Yeah, I like
there are that. Multiple restoration traditions. There's multiple ways to talk about and interpret this past. And now the fact that one church controls all of the sites and there will be one story told, that erases some of that diversity about our collective history. That I think that's kind of unfortunate.
Interesting. Now, a couple of young adults that I run into in the past couple of days, they believe that this is a sign of something bigger, either as far as, you know, we're getting towards the second coming, or a sign of something. Is it a sign of something, or can you put that
what
is
historian,
it, conspiracy theory to rest? Can you put that conspiracy theory to rest for them?
Well, I can't read the mind of God. That didn't come with my PhD, unfortunately. I tried to convince my children of that, but they're not convinced either. I would say that this is a sign of one church having a lot of money and another church not having enough money.
Sure.
That's what this is a sign of.
Yeah.
And I would say it's not a sign of much more than that.
I tried to say that to them, but I didn't have the right words. I was like, I don't know what you mean. And
one church
I'll ask
has
Patrick
a slush
Mason
fund.
Tomorrow.
Yeah.
So if it's okay, Patrick, I want to kind of put aside some of the academic expertise that you have. One thing I really admire about you is you just sort of decide what you want to do and how you want to do it. And you don't kind of ask for permission to do stuff. I think there's a lot of our listeners that can kind of relate to that. So I think that a lot of people feel like in order to have a voice in the church or in Mormon culture, they have to have some credentials. They have to maybe get permission from the church. What's been your approach to that? Because your PhD is in American history. It's not in peace, for example, although I'm sure you studied that. But right, you write on topics that are not necessarily your focus of training. So like, what guides you? What motivates you? How do you think about like public scholarship or like members of the church doing things they feel like they should do without permission from the church?
Yeah, I'm just a big believer in that revelation is a section 58 where I think where it says, you know, that we're called to be anxiously engaged in a good cause. And there's no credentials attached to that. Now it helps somewhat, right? I spent a lot of years training to be a historian and thinking about history, right? So I don't think that doesn't mean that my voice is more important than somebody else's. It just means that I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. Just like, you know, I would go to somebody who's gotten an MBA, you know, for business advice. That you wouldn't go to me for business advice. Right? So expertise does matter. I believe in expertise, and I believe in I also, in addition to that section, you know, of being anxiously engaged, I also really believe in section like 88 and 93, where it talks about the gaining all the education that we can, learning about all these things in the world, so that it's not to puff ourselves up, it's not to show how smart we are, but it's for the benefit of Zion. It's so that we can turn around and those things, those gifts and talents that we develop based on what God has given us, then we turn around and gift that back to other people. And So I feel really strongly about that. It's one of the reasons I like working at a state university, a public university. I think knowledge is a public good, and I think we have a responsibility to share that with the broader public. It's important to have some of these conversations just among experts, right? That's how we develop knowledge is within communities of knowledge. But then, you know, to translate it for the broader public. And so, yeah, you're right, Matt. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of idiosyncratic, the kinds of things that I care about. And I mean, you know, how can I explain the stuff that I'm interested in more than other things? You know, that's hard to know. But I just think that kind of all knowledge is good knowledge. And so I have a passion for certain things, or I've been led to certain things. So I'm just willing to kind of speak about and write about those things. Ultimately, especially my work on peace and violence, I just feel called to that kind of work and have for a long time. Not because of actually anything in my background. I lived a very boring life in suburban Sandy, right? I mean, I wasn't raised in a war zone. I haven't experienced any of that kind of trauma, but I just feel called to it as a Christian. And so that's just been an area of focus, just like other people focus on other issues that are really, really important, whether it be the environment or, you know, in any number of other things. I think people can be called to lots of different things. I just, for whatever reason, have been called to some of these particular topics. And so I'll just do the best that I can to lend my voice, again, whatever expertise I develop, and then my own feelings, my own faith as a disciple of Jesus, to try to just lift up my voice in some of these areas.
Mornings are better with a warm beverage, even for Latter-day Saints. Meet Postum, the ideal coffee alternative and proud sponsor of This Week in Mormons podcast. Spot it on the coffee aisle at Smith's Grocery or at your local nearby store. Can't locate it? No worries. Order it at postum.com. Explore delicious recipes to tailor your Postum experience. Start your day off right with Postum.
That's a really interesting perspective. I am also one who just loves to continuously be educated, right? Like, and I think all of us probably, that's the nature of our jobs, but it's just kind of who I am. I've always really loved that.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier, and I wonder if you have any thoughts about the fact that a lot of young people feel like they didn't get proper education about the church or its doctrines or its beliefs as they were growing up. And like, we're all, you know, doing the best we can. When you call me to teach Sunday school, you get what you get, right? Like, I am who I am. And I don't necessarily know everything. But like, my perspective has always been like, it's kind of on me to continue learning what I need to learn. But then I do also wonder about, you know, those young people who are like, yeah, but I almost feel lied to a little bit.
Yeah, it is tricky because, I actually don't think it's the job of a relief society to give graduate seminars in church history. I mean, that's just not what we're there for. I don't think that's the responsibility of a seminary teacher, although I do think that our seminaries and institutes bear more of a burden here than do our relief societies and elders' quorums.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we're doing on Sundays is something different. Now that doesn't mean we want to teach bad history or false history, right? So we want to make sure that we're responsible in those settings as well. But that's not the main job of what's going on during that hour. But it should be closer to the main job of what's going on in seminary and institute and religious ed, at the BYUs. And I think they're getting better at that. The material is getting better. The curriculum is getting better. I think the training is getting better. And so those teachers are, on the whole, I think, doing a better job of educating students on some of these difficult issues. It's uneven still, for sure. But it's better than it was 10 and certainly 30 years ago. But you're right. So I do think the institution has some obligation here. The church history department has been phenomenal, but not everybody knows about all the things that they're doing, right? Still, a lot of people don't know about the gospel topics essays. They don't know about these resources. They're actually within the Gospel Library app, but just nobody's ever pointed it out to them. And so there's a bit of a disconnect there between the resources the church actually does provide and then what members are aware of. But you're right. At some level, at a significant level, people are responsible for their own education, but people don't know what they don't know. And they don't even know what questions to ask. And so if they've never been exposed to anything at all, if nothing's ever even been mentioned or the possibility, oh, you know, this is kind of a complicated topic. You could look into it here. Here's some resources. Like, hey, look at the Gospel Library app. Here's some things that you could look at if you're interested more. So it's not that the teacher has to do all that work, but just to at least point students to a place where they can learn more if they have questions. I think we can do a better job of that. Otherwise, they really do feel blind, right? They feel unprepared. They feel like there's a kind of deception or like they were withholding information. So I think there's plenty of responsibility to go around in terms of all of us being able to do better here.
I don't know that there's such thing as objective history. I would imagine everyone has some kind of a bias. But when somebody asks you, like, where can I go to find really good quality information about questions I have about history of the church? What do you point them to?
Yeah, so it kind of depends on the person and where they're coming from and so forth. But especially if they're a member of the church, I will point them to the church's resources. I think those Gospel Topics essays are great. The Saints volumes are terrific. They really are based on – I mean, the Church History Department has just been knocking it out of the park for the past two decades. The Joseph Smith Papers, right? Those are all phenomenal projects based on really like the best quality scholarship. Now – those products are oriented, especially Saints and the Gospel Topics essays, those are oriented towards the community of faith. So there are other ways to looking at these things. But I always tell people, look at the footnotes, right? The footnotes, they're citing scholarship. So that's where I would tell people to go next is, you're right, there's no such thing as objective scholarship, but there is a pretty good system of how to produce really good, reliable scholarship that's been vetted, that's been peer reviewed, and that is the peer review process. So if you see a book, you know, coming out from a respectable university press, that doesn't mean everything in it is infallible. It's not the word of God, right? But it's the word of that historian. But it's been vetted. It's gone through a peer review process. Same thing with academic journals. They're not perfect. Sometimes they publish duds, right? Some of the things they publish end up being retracted or being contradicted. That's all just part. It's funny. I think people are kind of comfortable with this when it comes to science, right? They recognize like, oh, people experiment, they do experiments. And then somebody else comes along and does another experiment that overturns what we thought we knew with that others. I think there's a kind of comfort level there. But this, the exact same principle holds true in history as well, that the way that we produce history is really no different than we produce science. The other bad end of the spectrum would be, oh, we'll just throw it all out because it's none of it is objective, right? It's all just opinion. No, it's not just opinion. there are rigorous, you know, rules. There's a reason we call these disciplines, the discipline of history. There's a real rigor to it. It's not just like reading some dude's blog. So I would say go to peer-reviewed scholarship, go to what the community of professional scholars has produced over time.
Yeah. That's a good analogy with the way we look at science versus the way we look at history. I like that. In the past year, my husband and I, we've been serving in a university ward. And I have to tell you, it has been life-changing for me to see the church from the perspective of this younger generation. And I've loved it. You know, notably, they use the word Heavenly Parents much more than Heavenly Father, right? Ministering is talked about completely differently than when I was their age. The same thing with things like grace and repentance, completely different take on the gospel. And it's refreshing and I love it. And in some ways, I think that's Mormon culture because the doctrine hasn't really changed. I'm wondering if you have some notable things that you have seen that have changed in Mormon culture in the last, I don't know, decade or so.
Yeah, I would echo all of those things. We have not only, you know, the students that I see on campus, we have students over to our home on Sunday nights for gospel conversations. And so I'm hearing the exact same things. I think the biggest thing that's happened over the past 10, 15, 20 years is that this generation, they are converted to Jesus.
Yeah.
Like just full stop. Of course, you know, the church has always been based on faith in Jesus Christ. It's one of the articles of faith. It goes all the way back. But like my generation growing up, I wasn't converted to Jesus the way that these kids are converted to Jesus. And it is real. It is deep. In some ways, like congratulations to the church. Like we did that. We converted a whole generation to Jesus. That is our core mission. So like that's good work. That's good stuff. But here's the caveat there. Now this generation who's been converted to Jesus says, well, what would Jesus do? Right. And they train that gaze back on not only on society, but also back on the church. Mm-hmm. So they expect more from the church. They expect the church to be more Christian. They expect the church to do the works of Jesus. And when the church doesn't, either institutionally or culturally, they have less patience for it. So it's a kind of double-edged sword that the church is the one who converted them to Christianity. The church is the one that taught them all these lessons about love and tolerance and kindness and all these kinds of things. And right. So now they're expecting the church to live up to its own teachings. And sometimes that's hard for institutions. And so that's the biggest thing that I've seen, the difference between college students now versus when we were growing up.
Well, and when you were talking earlier about being anxiously engaged in a good cause, you talked about feeling called to it. And I think that that's something that's maybe finding a resurgence in the church, that the calling or what you feel like you should do in the church is not necessarily something that comes from a member of the bishopric. Like, we're all going to get those, right? And we're all going to get assignments to minister. But I do think that there's something about being converted to Jesus that says, I feel called to do this. I feel like I should do this. I feel like I should be a part of this. And I feel like there's more opportunities to do that now, maybe. Or maybe it's just more generally accepted now that people are doing that. Do you feel like young people are more that way too?
Totally. And this is a... this is one of the hallmarks of Gen Z, is a sense of recognizing that the world is broken in some fundamental ways and being impatient for change, wanting to change it. So that also is a kind of two-sided coin, that there's a deep sense of despair among many of Gen Z.
Do you mean because they don't have the power to make the change?
That's exactly it. They see all the problems and they feel like either the problems are insurmountable or that they don't have the power to change it.
Okay.
And so that is real. And this is not unique to me. Lots of people are saying this is helping drive the epidemic of anxiety, of depression, all these kinds. I mean, all the way down to them not having confidence that they're going to have a higher standard of living than their parents, and not being able to get good jobs and the housing market and all that. And then add to that climate change and racial injustice and gender inequality. I mean, so they see all these things. And on the one hand, there's this kind of despair about the state of the world. On the other hand, there's a sense of like, I want to go out and fix that. I want to go out and make the positive difference in the world. I want the world to be a better place. And I think that, So part of my message, whether in my writings about peace or in my book Restoration, I'm trying to help. I actually have this generation in mind when I'm writing that stuff. I have my students in mind because I want them. I love that sense that they have of wanting to change the world. I want to give them the vision, the resources for doing that they can find within their religion. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I go to church on Sunday and then I go out Monday through Saturday to go do good things in the world. Well, no, the reason why you go out and do that Monday through Saturday is because of the stuff you've learned on Sunday. And there's a way to integrate all of that. The reason you care about justice, the reason you care about equality, the reason you care about serving for the poor, if you can ground that in your Christianity and use your religion as a platform to do that, then you're going to be more powerful in doing that. But that's where a lot of people see the disconnect, right? It's like, mm-hmm. I go to church and I don't hear them talking about any of this stuff that I care about Monday through Saturday, mm-hmm. right? So it seems like I live in two different worlds. I go to church on Sunday and it's very sterile. It's very abstract. It's very, it's anything except, I never hear them talk about creation care. I never hear them talk about racial injustice. I never, right. And so that's, I think, where sometimes there's tension, whereas I think the restoration actually speaks powerfully to all of those issues. And so I just want a vision where we integrate those things rather than separate them.
Among my students at BYU Idaho, I've noticed this change since they lowered the age of missionary service for sisters. I've noticed that like the young women that are in my classes are much more empowered and like not waiting for permission to do things. Like to me, that change has been really important in empowering a new generation of young women. I wonder if you see the same thing at Utah State.
100%. I think it's phenomenal. I think it is one of the great things that's changed over the past 10 years. But now, like everything I say, because I'm an academic, like nothing is ever straightforward, right? There's always, well, but on the other hand, well, I think there's a very clear on the other hand here too, so these young women, they grew up in a world that told them that women can do anything. Mm-hmm. And then they went on missions And in missions now, over the past, whatever, 5-7 years or whatever, they largely have been empowered to do a lot of, you know, with training sisters and so forth. Yes, there's still a glass ceiling, but, but less of one, actually. They're pretty empowered. Then they come back to college where they're empowered, right? And then, but now they look at a future in the church and they see the glass ceiling.
Yeah. Right?
They see the patriarchy. They see, and I don't use that term lightly. I mean that in a very real sense of like, they recognize that every role and every responsibility they have in the church, they will always answer to a man. They will always be subject to a man's leadership. So even if they have egalitarian marriages, even if they, you know, do great things in the world, you know, in their home, in their communities, in the workplace, or whatever, they recognize that the church may be the one structurally sort of unequal place in their life where they literally face structural limitations. So that's again, they were empowered by their life in the church. Right? They grew up speaking in church, and they grew up giving service projects and serving in young women's presidencies, and then, you know, serving as training sisters,
baptisms, being all of these things,
doing all of these things.
Yeah,
right. Now they knew all along because they saw their brothers pass the sacrament and they didn't. Right. I mean, so it's there are all these inequalities all, but I think it really hits them when they become adults.
Do you see that too, Melissa?
You know, I'd never thought about it from that perspective before, and I'm the woman in the room, so it's interesting that I didn't. But it is like, I do think in my lifetime in the church, I have seen so much change, but I didn't really look at it from the perspective but that it only goes so high. It only goes to a certain point, and then you really are limited, yeah.
Well, and for people our age, like, if you grew up in the church, I expect, I mean, I don't know, Melissa, so tell me if I'm right. I mean, you have seen like gains and growth and more opportunities for women in the church, right? Compared to when you were young.
Yep.
But if you're a college student today, you started at a really high bar, right? So they don't recognize that all the things that you see as gains, that's the baseline for them.
You're right. Yeah. Really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to become frustrating. Yep, I can see that now.
So, Patrick, what do you have in the works right now? What are you working on right now?
Oh, always too many things. So, so one thing I care a lot about is a podcast that I'm doing with Mormon Women for Ethical Government, which is an amazing organization that works on bringing principles of peacemaking into the public square and into politics. So they invited me to co-host a podcast called Proclaim Peace, where we're talking about, especially this year, as we go through the Book of Mormon and Come Follow Me. So we're going through the Book of Mormon and pulling out principles of peacemaking from the Book of Mormon and talking about that. So that's a really fun project. I've always got books that I'm writing. I've got one book I'm writing on Ezra Taft Benson. He's a fascinating historical figure to me.
Wait a minute. Where are you getting primary source material on him?
Well, there's... I don't have access to his private papers in the church, but there's so much public material on him because he lived just such a long and public life, both as a church leader, but also as a political leader, as Secretary of Agriculture. And so so that's I've been working on that for years. I'm going to be finishing that up this year. And yeah, I've always got too many things going on, too many balls in the air.
Hey, let me just ask you if you can confirm this rumor I've heard. Is it true that you won't get any more stuff like Michael Quinn's access to the church archives for biographies of future general authorities? Has that stuff changed a lot?
So yes and no. So access to 19th century sources is really very open. It's the most open that it's ever been. So if you want to work on Joseph Smith, like literally everything has been published with the Joseph Smith papers, Brigham Young and other 19th century stuff, you can actually get most things. The church is very consistent that you can't get financial records. You can't get anything related to the temples, like to the temple ceremonies. And you can't get anything related to church courts or church discipline. So that's just off limits, no matter what. But other than that, 19th century records are really pretty wide open. It gets more limited in the 20th century.
Okay.
And so including somebody like Benson, partly because like people in his papers, some of them are still alive. right. And so it's actually pretty recent if you're talking about the 1960s, 70s, 80s. Right. I mean, and so part of it is around privacy issues and some things like that. So it does get a little sketchier there. But I just suspect over time that the church history department really is committed to a principle of transparency. It's not 100%, but no private organization is. Like, you couldn't walk into Apple and say, hey, can I see all your papers, right? Can I see all your numbers? So it's getting better. And there is a kind of rolling, you know, kind of timeline there. I'd say roughly 100 years or so. You know, if you're looking at stuff in the last 100 years, there's just going to be some things that you can't see. If you want to look at stuff from the first century of the Restoration, you're actually going to get access to almost not quite everything, but almost everything.
Does that excite you, Melissa? You ready to start your history?
I'm not interested in it at all, but thank you.
Hey, well, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us. It was great to chat with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.